The light of his lantern illuminated each in turn. One tunnel was walled with human bones, its roof supported by columns of skulls. Another opened on winding steps that descended farther still.
"How many cellars are there?" she wondered. "Do they just go down forever?"
"Sit," the priest commanded. She sat. "Now close your eyes, child." She closed her eyes. "This will hurt," he warned her, "but pain is the price of power. Do not move." "Still as stone," she thought. She sat on moving. The cut was quick, the blade sharp. By rights the metal should have been cold against her flesh, but it felt warm instead. She could feel the blood washing down her face, a rippling red curtain falling across her brow and cheeks and chin, and she understood why the priest had made her close her eyes. When it reached her lips, the taste was salt and copper. She licked at it and shivered.
"Bring me the face," the kindly man said.
The waif made no answer, but she could hear her slippers whispering over the stone floor. To the girl, he said, "Drink this," and pressed a cup into her hand. She drank it down at once. It was very tart, like biting into a lemon. 1,000 years ago, she had known a girl who loved lemon cakes.
"No, that was not me. That was only Aria."
"Mummers changed their faces with artifice," the kindly man was saying, "and sorcerers use glamours, weaving light and shadows and desire to make illusions that trick the eye. These arts you shall learn. But what we must do here goes deeper. Wise men can see through artifice, and glamours dissolve before sharp eyes, but the face you are about to don will be as true and solid as that face you were born with. Keep your eyes closed." She felt his fingers brushing back her hair.
"Stay still. This will feel queer. You may be dizzy, but you must not move."
Then came a tug and a soft rustling as the new face was pulled down over the old. The leather scraped across her brow, dry and stiff. But as her blood soaked into it, it softened, turned supple. Her cheeks grew warm, flushed. She could feel her heart fluttering beneath her breast, and for one long moment she could not catch her breath. Hands closed around her throat, hard as stone, choking her. Her own hands shut up to claw at the arms of her attacker, but there was no one there. A terrible sense of fear filled her, and she heard a noise, a hideous crunching noise, accompanied by blinding pain. A face floated in front of her, fat, bearded, brutal, his mouth twisted with rage. She heard the priest say,
"Breathe, child, breathe out the fear. Shake off the shadows. He is dead. She is dead. Her pain is gone. Breathe."
The girl took a deep, shuddering breath and realized it was true. No one was choking her. No one was hitting her. Even so, her hand was shaking as she raised it to her face. Flakes of dried blood crumbled at the touch of her fingertips, black in the lantern light. She felt her cheeks, touched her eyes, traced the line of her jaw.
"My face is still the same."
"Is it? Are you certain?" Was she certain? She had not felt any change, but maybe it was not something you could feel. She swept a hand down across her face from top to bottom, as she had once seen Jake and Hagar do, back at Harrenhal. When he did it, his whole face had rippled and changed. When she did it, nothing happened.
"It feels the same."
"To you," said the priest, "it does not look the same."
"To other eyes, your nose and jaw are broken," said the waif. "One side of your face is caved in, where your cheekbone shattered, and half your teeth are missing."
She probed around inside her mouth with her tongue, but found no holes or broken teeth.
"Sorcery," she thought. "I have a new face. an ugly, broken face.
"You may have bad dreams for a time," warned the kindly man.
"Her father beat her so often and so brutally that she was never truly free of pain or fear until she came to us."
"Did you kill him?"
"She asked the gift for herself, not for her father."
"You should have killed him." He must have read her thoughts.
"Death came for him in the end, as it comes for all men, as it must come for a certain man upon the morrow." He lifted up the lamp. "We are done here. For now."
As they made their way back to the steps, the empty eye holes of the skins upon the walls seemed to follow her. For a moment she could almost see their lips moving, whispering dark, sweet secrets to one another in words too faint to hear. Sleep did not come easily that night. Tangled in her blankets, she twisted this way and that in the cold, dark room. But whichever way she turned, she saw the faces.
"They have no eyes, but they can see me."
She saw her father's face upon the wall. Beside him hung her lady mother, and below them her three brothers all in a row.
"No, that was some other girl. I am no one, and my only brothers wear robes of black and white."
Yet there was the black singer. There the stable boy she'd killed with needle. There the pimply squire from the Crossroads Inn. And over there the guard whose throat she'd slashed to get them out of Harrenhall. The tickler hung on the wall as well, the black holes that were his eyes swimming with malice. The sight of him brought back the feel of the dagger in her hand, as she had plunged it into his back again and again and again. When at last day came to Braavos, it came grey and dark and overcast. The girl had hoped for fog, but the guards ignored her prayers, as guards so often did. The air was clear and cold, and the wind had a nasty bite to it.
"A good day for a death," she thought.
Unbidden, her prayer came to her lips.
"Sir Gregor, Dunson, Wraith the Sweetling, Sir Ilin, Sir Merin, Queen Circe."
She mouthed the name silently. In the house of black and white, you never knew who might be listening. The vaults were full of old clothing, garments claimed from those who came to the House of Black and White to drink peace from the temple pool. Everything from beggar's rags to rich silks and velvets could be found there.
"An ugly girl should dress in ugly clothing," she decided,
so she chose a stained brown cloak fraying at the hem, a musty green tunic smelling of fish, and a pair of heavy boots. Last of all, she palmed her finger knife.
There was no haste,
so she decided to take the long way round to the Purple Harbour. Across the bridge she went to the Isle of the Gods. Cat of the Canals had sold cockles and mussels amongst the temples here, whenever Brusque's daughter Talia had her moon blood flowing and took to her bed. She half expected to see Talia selling there today, perhaps outside the warren, where all the forgotten godlings had their forlorn little shrines. But that was silly. The day was too cold, and Talia never liked to wake this early. The statue outside the shrine of the Weeping Lady of Lice was crying silver tears as the ugly girl walked by. In the gardens of Gelenai stood a gilded tree 100 feet high, with leaves of hammered silver. Torchlight glimmered behind windows of leaded glass in the Lord of Harmony's wooden hall, showing 50 kinds of butterflies in all their bright colours. One time, the girl remembered, the sailor's wife had walked her rounds with her and told her tales of the city's stranger gods.
"That is the house of the great shepherd, three-headed Trius, has had that tower with three turrets. The first head devours the dying, and the reborn emerge from the third. I don't know what the middle head's supposed to do. Those are the stones to the silent god, and there the entrance to the pattern-maker's maze. Only those who learn to walk it properly will ever find their way to wisdom, the priests of the pattern say. Beyond it, by the canal, that's the temple of Aquan, the red bull. Every 13th day, his priests slit the throat of a pure white calf and offer bowls of blood to beggars.
Today was not the 13th day, it seemed. The red bull steps were empty. The brother gods, Semosh and Saloso, dreamed in twin temples on opposite sides of the Black Canal, linked by a carved stone bridge. The girl crossed there and made her way down to the docks, then through the Ragman's Harbour and past the half-sunken spires and domes of the drowned town. A group of Lycian sailors were staggering from the happy port as she went by, but the girl did not see any of the whores. The ship was closed up and forlorn, its troop of mummers no doubt still abed. But farther on the wharf, beside an Ebony's whaler, she spied Cat's old friend, Taganaro, tossing a ball back and forth with Casso, king of seals, whilst his latest cot purse worked the crowd of onlookers. When she stopped to watch and listen for a moment, Taganaro glanced at her without recognition. But Casso barked and clapped his flippers.
"He knows me," the girl thought, "or else he smells the fish."
She hurried on her way. By the time she reached the Purple Harbour, the old man was ensconced inside the soup shop at his usual table, counting a purse of coins as he haggled with the ship's captain. The tall, thin guard was hovering over him. The short, thick one was seated near the door, where he would have a good view of anyone who entered. That made no matter. She did not intend to enter. Instead, she perched atop a wooden piling 20 yards away, as the blustery wind tugged at her cloak with ghostly fingers. Even on a cold, grey day like this, the harbour was a busy place. She saw sailors on the prowl for whores, and whores on the prowl for sailors. A pair of bravos passed in rumpled finery, leaning on each other as they staggered drunkenly past the docks, their blades rattling at their sides. A red priest swept past, his scarlet and crimson robes snapping in the wind. It was almost noon before she saw the man she wanted, a prosperous shipowner she had seen doing business with the old man 3 times before. Big and bald and burly, he wore a heavy cloak of plush brown velvet trimmed with fur, and a brown leather belt ornamented with silver moons and stars. Some mishap had left one leg stiff. He walked slowly, leaning on a cane. He would do as well as any, and better than most, the ugly girl decided. She hopped off the piling and fell in after him. A dozen strides put her right behind him, her finger knife poised. His purse was on his right side, at his belt, but his cloak was in her way. Her blade flashed out, smooth and quick, one deep slash through the velvet, and he never felt a thing. Red Rogo would have smiled to see it. She slipped her hand through the gap, slit the purse open with a finger knife, filled her fist with gold. The big man turned.
"What?"
The movement tangled her arm in the folds of his cloak as she was pulling out her hand. Coins rained round their feet.
"Thief!"
The big man raised his stick to strike at her. She kicked his bad leg out from under him, danced away, and bolted as he fell, darting past a mother with a child. More coins fell from between her fingers to bounce along the ground. Shouts of "Thief! Thief!" rang out behind her. A pot-bellied innkeep passing by made a clumsy grab for her arm, but she spun around him, flashed past a laughing whore, raced headlong for the nearest alley. Cat of the Canals had known these alleys, and the ugly girl remembered. She darted left, vaulted a low wall, leapt across a small canal, then slipped through an unlocked door into some dusty storeroom. All sounds of pursuit had faded by then, but it was best to be sure. She hunkered down behind some crates and waited, arms wrapped around her knees. She waited for the best part of an hour, then decided it was safe to go, climbed straight up the side of the building and made her way across the rooftops almost as far as the Canal of Heroes. By now the ship owner would have gathered up coins and cane and limped onto the soup shop. He might be drinking a bowl of hot broth and complaining to the old man about the ugly girl who had tried to rub his purse. The kindly man was waiting for her at the House of Black and White, seated on the edge of the temple pool. The ugly girl sat next to him and put a coin on the lip of the pool between them. It was gold, with a dragon on one face and a king on the other.
"The Golden Dragon of Westeros," said the kindly man. "And how did you come by this? We are no thieves." "It wasn't stealing. I took one of his, but I left him one of ours."
The kindly man understood.
"And with that coin and the others in his purse, he paid a certain man. Soon after, that man's heart gave out. Is that the way of it? Very sad."
The priest picked up the coin and tossed it into the pool.
"You have much and more to learn, but it may be you are not hopeless."
That night they gave her back the face of Arya Stark. They brought a robe for her as well, the soft, thick robe of an acolyte, black upon one side and white upon the other.
"Wear this when you are here," the priest said, "but know that you shall have little need of it for the present. On the morrow you will go to Isambaro to begin your first apprenticeship. Take what clothes you will from the vaults below. The city watch is looking for a certain ugly girl known to frequent the Purple Harbor, so best you have a new face as well."
He cupped her chin, turned her head this way and that, nodded.
"A pretty one this time, I think. As pretty as your own. Who are you, child?"
"No one," she replied.
Cersei. On the last night of her imprisonment, the queen could not sleep. Each time she closed her eyes, her head filled with forebodings and fantasies of the morrow. "I will have guards," she told herself.
"They will keep the crowds away. No one will be allowed to touch me."
The High Sparrow had promised her that much. Even so, she was afraid. On the day Marcella sailed for Dawn, the day of the bread riots, gold cloaks had been posted all along the route of the procession, but the mob had broken through their lines to tear the old fat High Septon into pieces and rape Lolly Stokeworth 50 times. And if that pale, soft, stupid creature could incite the animals when fully clothed, how much more lust would a queen inspire? Cersei paced her cell, restless as the caged lions that had lived in the bowels of Castle Rock when she was a girl, a legacy of her grandfather's time. She and Jaime used to dare each other to climb into their cage, and once she worked up enough courage to slip her hand between two bars and touch one of the great tawny beasts. She was always bolder than her brother. The lion had turned his head to stare at her with huge golden eyes. Then he licked her fingers. His tongue was as rough as a rasp, but even so she would not pull her hand back, not until Jaime took her by the shoulders and yanked her away from the cage.
"Your turn," she told him afterward. "Police mean, I dare you."
He never did. "I should have had the sword, not him." Barefoot and shivering, she paced, a thin blanket draped about her shoulders. She was anxious for the day to come. By evening, it would all be done.
"A little walk and I'll be home. I'll be back with Tommen, in my own chambers, inside Maegor's holdfast."
Her uncle said it was the only way to save herself. Was it, though? She could not trust her uncle, no more that she trusted this high septon. I could still refuse. I could still insist upon my innocence and hazard all upon a trial. But she dare not let the faith sit in judgment on her, as that Marjorie Tyrell meant to do. That might serve the little Rose well enough, but Cersei had few friends amongst the scepters and sparrows around this new high septon. Her only hope was trial by battle, and for that she must needs have a champion. If Jamie had not lost his hand. That road led nowhere, though. Jamie's sword hand was gone, and so was he, vanished with the woman Brienne, somewhere in the Riverlands. The queen had to find another defender, or today's ordeal would be the least of her travails. Her enemies were accusing her of treason. She had to reach Tommen, no matter the costs.
"He loves me. He will not refuse his own mother. Joff was stubborn and unpredictable, but Tommen is a good little boy, a good little king. He will do as he's told."
If she stayed here, she was doomed, and the only way she would return to the Red Keep was by walking. The High Sparrow had been adamant, and Sir Kevin refused to lift a finger against him. "No harm will come to me today," Cersei said, when the day's first light brushed her window. "Only my pride will suffer." The words rang hollow in her ears.
"Jamie may yet come."
She pictured him riding through the morning mist, his golden armour bright in the light of the rising sun.
"Jamie, if you ever loved me."
When her jailers came for her, Septa Yunella, Septa Moel, and Septa Scalera led the procession. With them were four novices and two of the Silent Sisters. The sight of the Silent Sisters in their grey robes filled the queen with sudden terrors.
"Why are they here? Am I to die?"
The Silent Sisters attended to the dead.
"The High Septon promised that no harm would come to me."
"Nor will it."
Septa Yunella beckoned to the novices. They brought lye soap, a basin of warm water, a pair of shears, and a long, straight razor. The sight of the steel sent a shiver through her.
"They mean to shave me. A little more humiliation, a raisin for my porridge."
She would not give them the pleasure of hearing her beg.
"I am Cersei of House Lannister, a Lion of the Rock, the rightful queen of these seven kingdoms, true-born daughter of Tywin Lannister. And hair grows back. Get on with it," she said.
The elder of the two Silent Sisters took up the shears, a practiced barber, no doubt. Her order often cleaned the corpses of the noble slain before returning them to their kin, and trimming beards and cutting hair was part of that. The woman bared the queen's head first. Cersei sat as still as a stone statue as the shears clicked. Drifts of golden hair fell to the floor. She had not been allowed to tend it properly, penned up in a cell, but even unwashed and tangled, it shone where the sun touched it. "My crown," the queen thought. "They took the other crown away from me, and now they are stealing this one as well." When her locks and curls were piled up around her feet, one of the novices soaped her head, and the Silent Sister scraped away the stubble with a razor. Cersei hoped that would be the end of it. But no.
"Remove your shift, your grace," Septa Yunella commanded.
"Here?" the queen asked.
"Why?" "You must be shorn."
"Shorn?" she thought, "like a sheep." She yanked the shift over her head and tossed it to the floor.
"Do what you will."
Then it was the soap again, the warm water, and the razor. The hair beneath her arms went next, then her legs, and last of all the fine golden down that covered her mound. When the Silent Sister crept between her legs with a razor, Cersei found herself remembering all the times that Jamie had knelt where she was kneeling now, planting kisses on the inside of her thighs, making her wet. His kisses were always warm. The razor was ice cold. When the deed was done, she was as naked and vulnerable as a woman could be. Not even a hair to hide behind. A little laugh burst from her lips, bleak and bitter.
Does your grace find this amusing?
Said Scepter Scalera. No, Scepter, said Circe. But one day I will have your tongue ripped out with hot pincers, and that will be hilarious. One of the novices had brought a robe for her, a soft white scepter's robe, to cover her as she made her way down the tower steps and through the sept, so any worshippers they met along the way might be spared the sight of naked flesh. Seven save us all. What hypocrites they are!
Will I be permitted a pair of sandals? She asked. The streets are filthy. Not so filthy as your sins, said Scepter Moel. His High Holiness has commanded that you present yourself as the gods made you. Did you have sandals on your feet when you came forth from your lady mother's womb?
No, Scepter, the queen was forced to say.
Then you have your answer.
A bell began to toll. The queen's long imprisonment was at an end. Circe pulled the robe tighter, grateful for its warmth, and said,
Let us go.
Her son awaited her across the city. The sooner she set out, the sooner she would see him. The rough stone of the steps scraped her soles as Circe Lannister made her descent. She had come to Baelor's Sept a queen, riding in a litter. She was leaving bald and barefoot. But I am leaving. That is all that matters. The tower bells were singing, summoning the city to bear witness to her shame. The great sept of Baelor was crowded with faithful come for the dawn service, the sound of their prayers echoing off the dome overhead. But when the queen's procession made its appearance, a sudden silence fell, and a thousand eyes turned to follow her as she made her way down the aisle, past the place where her lord father had lain in state after his murder. Circe swept by them, looking neither right nor left. Her bare feet slapped against the cold marble floor. She could feel the eyes. Behind their altars, the seven seemed to watch as well. In the Hall of Lamps, a dozen warriors' sons awaited her coming. Rainbow cloaks hung down their backs, and the crystals that crested their great helms glittered in the lamplight. Their armour was silver plate, polished to a mirror sheen, but underneath, she knew, every man of them wore a hair shirt. Their kite shields all bore the same device, a crystal sword shining in the darkness, the ancient badge of those the small folk called swords. Their captain knelt before her. Perhaps your grace will recall me. I am Sir Theodan the True, and His High Holiness has given me command of your escort. My brothers and I will see you safely through the city. Cersei's gaze swept across the faces of the men behind him. And there he was, Lancel, her cousin, Sir Kevin's son, who had once professed to love her, before he decided that he loved the gods more. My blood and my betrayer. She would not forget him. You may rise, Sir Theodan. I am ready. The knight stood, turned, raised a hand. Two of his men stepped to the towering doors and pushed them open. And Circe walked through them into the open air, blinking at the sunlight like a mole roused from its burrow. A gusty wind was blowing, and it set the bottom of her robe snapping and flapping at her legs. The morning air was thick with the old familiar stinks of King's Landing. She breathed in the scents of sour wine, bread baking, rotting fish and night soil, smoke and sweat and horse piss. No flower had ever smelt so sweet. Huddled in her robe, Circe paused atop the marble steps as the warrior's sons formed up around her. It came to her suddenly that she had stood in this very spot before, on the day Lord Eddard Stark had lost his head. That was not supposed to happen. Joff was supposed to spare his life and send him to the Wall. Stark's elder son would have followed him as Lord of Winterfell, but Sansa would have stayed at court, a hostage. Varys and Littlefinger had worked out the terms, and Ned Stark had swallowed his precious honour and confessed his treason to save his daughter's empty little head. I would have made Sansa a good marriage. A Lannister marriage. Not Joff, of course, but Lancel might have suited, or one of his younger brothers. Peter Baelish had offered to wed the girl himself, she recalled. But, of course, that was impossible. He was much too low-born. If Joff had only done as he was told, Winterfell would never have gone to war, and father would have dealt with Robert's brothers. Instead, Joff had commanded that Stark's head be struck off, and Lord Slint and Sir Ellen Payne had hastened to obey. "It was just there," the Queen recalled, gazing at the spot. Jaina Slint had lifted Ned Stark's head by the hair as his life's blood flowed down the steps, and after that there was no turning back. The memories seemed so distant. Joffrey was dead, and all Stark's sons as well. Even her father had perished. And here she stood, on the steps of the great sept again. Only this time, it was her the mob was staring at, not Eddard Stark. The wide marble plaza below was as crowded as it had been on the day that Stark had died. Everywhere she looked, the Queen saw eyes. The mob seemed to be equal parts men and women. Some had children on their shoulders, beggars and thieves, tavern keepers and trade folk, tanners and stable boys and mummers, the poorer sort of whore. All the scum had come out to see a queen brought low. And mingled in with them were the poor fellows, filthy, unshaven creatures, armed with spears and axes and clad in bits of dinted plate, rusted mail and cracked leather, under rough-spun surcoats bleached white and blazoned with the seven-pointed star of the faith. The High Sparrow's ragged army. Part of her still yearned for Jaime to appear and rescue her from this humiliation. But her twin was nowhere to be seen, nor was her uncle present. That did not surprise her. Sir Kevin had made his views plain during his last visit. Her shame must not be allowed to tarnish the honour of Casterly Rock. No lions would walk with her today. This ordeal was hers, and hers alone. Scepter Unella stood to her right, Scepter Moel to her left, Scepter Scalera behind her. If the Queen should bolt or balk, the three hags would drag her back inside, and this time they would see to it that she never left her cell. Cersei raised her head. Beyond the plaza, beyond the sea of hungry eyes and gaping mouths and dirty faces across the city, Aegon's high hill rose in the distance, the towers and battlements of the Red Keep blushing pink in the light of the rising sun. "It is not so far." Once she reached its gates, the worst of her travails would be over. She would have her son again. She would have her champion. Her uncle had promised her. "Tommen is waiting for me. My little king. I can do this. I must." Scepter Unella stepped forward. "A sinner comes before you," she declared. "She is Cersei of House Lannister, Queen Dowager, mother to his grace King Tommen, widow of his grace King Robert, and she has committed grievous falsehoods and fornications." Scepter Moel moved up to the Queen's right. "This sinner has confessed her sins and begged for absolution and forgiveness. His High Holiness has commanded her to demonstrate her repentance by putting aside all pride and artifice and presenting herself as the God's Maiden before the good people of the city." Scepter Scalera finished. "So now this sinner
comes before you with a humble heart, shorn of secrets and concealments, naked before the eyes of gods and men, to make her walk of atonement.
Cersei had been a year old when her grandfather died. The first thing her father had done on his accession was to expel his own father's grasping, low-born mistress from Casterly Rock. The silks and velvets Lord Titus had lavished on her, and the jewelry she had taken for herself, had been stripped from her, and she had been sent forth naked to walk through the streets of Lannisport, so the West could see her for what she was. Though she had been too young to witness the spectacle herself, Cersei had heard the stories growing up from the mouths of washerwomen and guardsmen who had been there. They spoke of how the woman had wept and begged, of the desperate way she clung to her garments when she was commanded to disrobe, of her futile efforts to cover her breasts and her sex with her hands as she hobbled barefoot and naked through the streets to exile.
"Vain and proud she was before," she remembered one guard saying. "So haughty, you think she'd forgot she'd come from dirt. Once we got her clothes off her, though, she was just another whore."
If Sir Kevin and the High Sparrow thought that it would be the same with her, they were very much mistaken. Lord Tywin's blood was in her.
"I am a lioness. I will not cringe for them."
The Queen shrugged off her robe. She bared herself in one smooth, unhurried motion, as if she were back in her own chambers, disrobing for her bath with no one but her bedmaids looking on. When the cold wind touched her skin, she shivered violently. It took all her strength of will not to try and hide herself with her hands, as her grandfather's whore had done. Her fingers tightened into fists, her nails digging into her palms. They were looking at her, all the hungry eyes. But what were they seeing? "I am beautiful," she reminded herself. How many times had Jamie told her that? Even Robert had given her that much when he came to her bed in his cups to pay her drunken homage with his cock. They looked at Ned Stark the same way, though. She had to move. Naked, shorn, barefoot, Cersei made a slow descent down the broad marble steps. Goose prickles rose on her arms and legs. She held her chin high, as a queen should, and her escort fanned out ahead of her. The poor fellows shoved men aside to open a way through the crowd, whilst the swords fell in on either side of her. Scepter Unella, Scepter Scalera, and Scepter Moel followed. Behind them came the novice girls in white.
"Whore!"
someone cried out, a woman's voice. Women were always the cruelest where other women were concerned. Cersei ignored her. "There will be more and worse. These creatures have no sweeter joy in life than jeering at their betters." She could not silence them, so she must pretend she did not hear them. She would not see them either. She would keep her eyes on Aegon's high hill across the city, on the towers of the Red Keep shimmering in the light. That was where she would find her salvation, if her uncle had kept his part of their bargain. "He wanted this, him and the High Sparrow, and the little Rose as well, I do not doubt. I have sinned and must atone, must parade my shame before the eyes of every beggar in the city. They think that this will break my pride, that it will make an end to me. But they are wrong." Scepter Unella and Scepter Moel kept pace with her, with Scepter Scalera scurrying behind, ringing a bell.
"Shame!" the old hag called. "Shame upon the sinner! Shame! Shame!"
Somewhere off to the right, another voice sang counterpoint to hers, some baker's boy shouting,
"Meat pies! 3 pence! Up, meat pies, here!"
The marble underfoot was cold and slippery, and Cersei had to step carefully for fear of slipping. Their path took them past the statue of Bador the Blessed, standing tall and serene upon his plinth, his face a study in benevolence. To look at him, you would never guess what a fool he'd been. The Tigerian dynasty had produced kings both bad and good, but none as beloved as Bailor. That pious, gentle Septon king, who loved the small folk and the gods in equal parts, yet imprisoned his own sisters. It was a wonder that his statue did not crumble at the sight of her bare breasts. Tyrion used to say that King Bailor was terrified of his own cock. Once, she recalled, he had expelled all the whores from King's Landing. He prayed for them, as they were driven from the city gates, the history said, but would not look at them.
"Harlot!"
a voice screamed, another woman. Something flew out of the crowd, some rotted vegetable. Brown and oozing, it sailed above her head to splash at the foot of one of the poor fellows. "I'm not afraid. I am a lioness," she walked on.
"Hot pies!" the baker's boy was crying. "Get your hot pies here!"
Septa Scalera rang her bell, singing, "Shame, shame, shame upon the sinner! Shame, shame!" The poor fellows went before them, forcing men aside with their shields, walling off a narrow path. Circe followed where they led, her head held stiffly, her eyes on the far distance. Every step brought the red keep nearer. Every step brought her closer to her son and her salvation. It seemed to take 100 years to cross the plaza, but finally marble gave way to cobblestones beneath her feet. Shops and stables and houses closed in all around them, and they began the descent of Vicenia's Hill. The going was slower here. The street was steep and narrow, the crowds jammed together tightly. The poor fellows shoved at those who blocked the way, trying to move them aside. But there was nowhere to go, and those in the back of the crowd were shoving back. Circe tried to keep her head up, only to step in something slick and wet that made her slip. She might have fallen, but Septa Eunella caught her arm and kept her on her feet.
"Your Grace should watch where she sets her feet."
Circe wrenched herself free. "Yes, Septa," she said in a meek voice, though she was angry enough to spit. The queen walked on, clad only in goose prickles and pride. She looked for the red keep, but it was hidden now, walled off from her gaze by the tall timbered buildings to either side.
"Shame! Shame!" sang Septa Scalera, her bell clanging.
Circe tried to walk faster, but soon came up against the backs of the stars in front of her, and had to slow her steps again. A man just ahead was selling skewers of roast meat from a cart, and the procession halted as the poor fellows moved him out of the way. The meat looked suspiciously like rat to Circe's eyes, but the smell of it filled the air, and half the men around them were gnawing away with sticks in hand by the time the street was clear enough for her to resume her trek.
"Want some, Your Grace?" one man called out.
He was a big, burly brute with pig eyes, a massive gut, and an unkempt black beard that reminded her of Robert. When she looked away in disgust, he flung the skewer at her. It struck her in the leg and tumbled to the street, and the half-cooked meat left a smear of grease and blood down her thigh. The shouting seemed louder here than on the plaza, perhaps because the mob was so much closer.
"Whore and sinner!" were most common. "But brother fucker!" and "cunt!" and "traitor!" were flung at her as well.
And now and again she heard someone shout out for Stannis or Margaery. The cobbles underfoot were filthy, and there was so little space that the queen could not even walk around the puddles. "No one has ever died of wet feet," she told herself. She wanted to believe the puddles were just rainwater, though horse piss was just as likely. More refuse showered down from windows and balconies, half-rotted fruit, pails of beer, eggs that exploded into a sulphurous stink when they cracked open on the ground. Then someone flung a dead cat over the poor fellows and warriors' sons alike. The carcass hit the cobble so hard that it burst open, spattering her lower legs with entrails and maggots. Cersei walked on. "I am blind and deaf, and they are worms," she told herself. "Shame, shame," the scepter sang.
"Chestnuts, hot roast chestnuts,"
a peddler cried.
"Queen cunt,"
a drunkard pronounced solemnly from a balcony above, lifting his cup to her in a mocking toast.
"All hail the royal teats!"
"Words are wind," Cersei thought. "Words cannot harm me." Halfway down Visenya's hill, the queen fell for the first time, when her foot slipped in something that might have been night soil. When Scepter Eunella pulled her up, her knee was scraped and bloody. A ragged laugh rippled through the crowd, and some man shouted out an offer to kiss it and make it better. Cersei looked behind her. She could still see the great dome and seven crystal towers of the great Scepter Baelor atop the hill. "Have I really just come such a little way?" Worse, 100 times worse, she had lost sight of the Red Keep.
"Where? Where?"
"Your Grace," the captain of her escort stepped up beside her. Cersei had forgotten his name.
"You must continue. The crowd is growing unruly."
"Yes," she thought, "unruly. I am not afraid.
You should be."
He yanked at her arm, pulling her along beside him. She staggered down the hill, downward, ever downward, wincing with every step, letting him support her. "It should be Jaime beside me. He would draw his golden sword and slash a path right through the mob, carving the eyes out of the head of every man who dared to look at her." The paving stones were cracked and uneven, slippery underfoot, and rough against her soft feet. Her heel came down on something sharp, a stone or piece of broken crockery. Cersei cried out in pain.
"I asked for sandals," she spat at Scepter Eunella. "You could have given me sandals? You could have done that much?"
The knight wrenched at her arm again, as if she were some common serving wench.
"Has he forgotten who I am? She was the queen of Westeros. He had no right to lay rough hands on her."
Near the bottom of the hill, the slope gentled, and the street began to widen. Cersei could see the Red Keep again, shining crimson in the morning sun atop Aegon's high hill. "I must keep walking." She wrenched free of Sir Theodan's grasp.
"You do not need to drag me, sir."
She limped on, leaving a trail of bloody footprints on the stones behind her. She walked through mud and dung, bleeding, goose-fleshed, hobbling. All around her was a babble of sound.
"My wife is sweet at teats and nose," a man shouted.
A teamster cursed as the poor fellows ordered his wagon out of the way.
"Shame, shame, shame on the sinner," chanted the scepters. "Look at this one,"
a whore called from a brothel window, lifting her skirts to the men below.
"It's not had half as many cocks up it as hers."
Bells were ringing, ringing, ringing.
"That can't be the queen," a boy said. "She's saggy as my mum."
"This is my penance," Cersei told herself. "I have sinned most grievously. This is my atonement. It will be over soon. It will be behind me. Then I can forget." The queen began to see familiar faces. A bald man with bushy side whiskers frowned down from a window with her father's frown, and for an instant looked so much like Lord Tywin that she stumbled. A young girl sat beneath a fountain, drenched in spray, and stared at her with Malara Heatherspoon's accusing eyes. She saw Ned Stark, and beside him little Sansa, with her auburn hair and a shaggy grey dog that might have been her wolf. Every child squirming through the crowd became her brother Tyrion, jeering at her as he had jeered when Joffrey died. And there was Joff as well, her son, her firstborn, her beautiful, bright boy, with his golden curls and his sweet smile. He had such lovely lips. That was when she fell the second time. She was shaking like a leaf when they pulled her to her feet.
"Please," she said, "Mother, have mercy. I confessed."
"You did," said Septimoel. "This is your atonement."
"It is not much farther," said Septimoel. "See," she pointed, "up the hill. That's all."
"Up the hill, that's all." It was true. They were at the foot of Aegon's high hill, the castle above them.
"Hur!"
someone screamed.
"Brother Fucker,"
another voice added.
"Abomination! Want to suck on this, your grace?"
A man in a butcher's apron pulled his cock out of his breeches, grinning. It did not matter. She was almost home. Cersei began to climb. If anything, the jeers and shouts were cruder here. Her walk had not taken her through Flea Bottom, so its denizens had packed onto the lower slopes of Aegon's high hill to see the show. The faces leering out at her from behind the shields and spears of the poor fellows seemed twisted, monstrous, hideous. Pigs and naked children were everywhere underfoot, crippled beggars and cut purses swarmed like roaches through the press. She saw men whose teeth had been filed into points, hags with goiters as big as their heads, a whore with a huge striped snake draped about her breasts and shoulders, a man whose cheeks and brow were covered with open sores that wept grey pus. They grinned and licked their lips and hooted at her as she went limping past, her breasts heaving with the effort of the climb. Some shouted obscene proposals, others insults.
"Words are wind," she thought. "Words cannot hurt me. I am beautiful, the most beautiful woman in all Westeros. Jaime says so. Jaime would never lie to me. Even Robert. Robert never loved me, but he saw that I was beautiful. He wanted me."
She did not feel beautiful, though. She felt old, used, filthy, ugly. There were stretch marks on her belly from the children she had borne, and her breasts were not as firm as they had been when she was younger. Without a gown to hold them up, they sagged against her chest. "I should not have done this. I was their queen. But now they've seen, they've seen, they've seen. I should never have let them see." Gowned and crowned, she was a queen. Naked, bloody, limping, she was only a woman. Not so very different from their wives, more like their mothers than their pretty little maiden daughters. "What have I done?" There was something in her eyes, stinging, blurring her sight. She could not cry. She would not cry. The worms must never see her weep. Cersei rubbed her eyes with the heels of her hands. A gust of cold wind made her shiver violently. And suddenly, the hag was there, standing in the crowd with her pendulous teats and her warty, greenish skin, leering with the rest, with malice shining from her crusty, yellow eyes.
"Queen, you shall be," she hissed, "until there comes another, younger and more beautiful, to cast you down and take all you hold most dear."
And then there was no stopping the tears. They burned down the queen's cheeks like acid. Cersei gave a sharp cry, covered her nipples with one arm, slid the other down to hide her slit, and began to run, shoving her way past the line of poor fellows, crouching as she scrambled crab-legged up the hill. Partway up, she stumbled and fell, rose and fell again 10 yards further on. The next thing she knew, she was crawling, scrambling uphill on all fours like a dog, as the good folk of King's Landing made way for her, laughing and jeering and applauding her. Then all at once the crowd parted and seemed to dissolve, and there were the castle gates before her, and a line of spearmen in gilded half-helms and crimson cloaks. Circe heard the gruff, familiar sound of her uncle growling orders, and glimpsed a flash of white to either side as Sir Boris Blunt and Sir Meryn Trant strode toward her in their pale plate and snowy cloaks.
"My son!" she cried. "Where is my son? Where is Tommen?"
"Not here. No son should have to bear witness to his mother's shame." Sir Kevin's voice was harsh. "Cover her up." Then Jocelyn was bending over her, wrapping her in a soft, clean blanket of green wool to cover up her nakedness. A shadow fell across them both, blotting out the sun. The queen felt cold steel slide beneath her, a pair of great armored arms lifting her off the ground, lifting her up into the air as easily as she had lifted Joffrey when he was still a babe. "A giant," thought Circe, dizzy, as he carried her with great strides toward the gatehouse. She had heard that giants could still be found in the godless wild beyond the wall.
"That is just a tale. Am I dreaming?"
No. Her savior was real. 8 feet tall, or maybe taller, with legs as thick around as trees, he had a chest worthy of a plough horse, and shoulders that would not disgrace an ox. His armor was plate steel, enameled white and bright as a maiden's hopes, and worn over gilded mail. A great helm hid his face. From its crest streamed 7 silken plumes in the rainbow colors of the faith. A pair of golden 7-pointed stars clasped his billowing cloak at the shoulders. A white cloak! Sir Kevin had kept his part of the bargain. Tommen, her precious little boy, had named her champion to the king's guard. Circe never saw where Kyburn came from, but suddenly he was there beside them, scrambling to keep up with her champion's long strides. "Your grace," he said, "it is so good to have you back. May I have the honor of presenting our newest member of the king's guard? This is Sir Robert Strong."
"Sir Robert," Circe whispered as they entered the gates.
"If it please your grace, Sir Robert has taken a holy vow of silence," Kyburn said. "He has sworn that he will not speak until all of his grace's enemies are dead, and evil has been driven from the realm."
"Yes," thought Circe Lannister. "Oh, yes."
Tyrion. The pile of parchments was formidably high. Tyrion looked at it and sighed. "I had understood you were a band of brothers. Is this the love a brother bears a brother? Where is the trust, the friendship, the fond regard, the deep affection that only men who have fought and bled together can ever know?"
"All in time," said Brown Ben Plunton.
"After you sign," said Inkpots, sharpening a quill. Casporeo the Cunning touched his sword hilt.
"If you would like to start the bleeding now, I will happily oblige you."
"How kind of you to offer," said Tyrion. "I think not." Inkpots placed the parchments before Tyrion and handed him the quill. "Here is your ink. From old Valentisis, 'twill last as long as proper maester's black. All you need do is sign and pass the notes to me. I'll do the rest." Tyrion gave him a crooked grin. "Might I read them first?" "If you like. They're all the same, by and large, except for the ones at the bottom. But we'll get to those in due course."
"Oh, I'm sure we will."
For most men, there was no cost to joining a company, but he was not most men. He dipped the quill into the inkpot, leaned over the first parchment, paused, looked up. "Would you prefer me to sign Yellow or Hugo Hill?"
Brown Ben crinkled up his eyes.
"Would you prefer to be returned to Yezzan's heirs, or just beheaded?"
The dwarf laughed and signed the parchment. Tyrion of House Lannister. As he passed at left-wing pots, he riffled through the pile underneath. There are